As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by Alex Stewart.
Hi, Joe.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, fine.
You know. Well, we're miserable because there's no Seb today. Because he's got bad internet in Germany, where you would have thought it would all be fine. We'll be talking today, though, about some interesting things. Marcel Brands, of course, has left Everton, so we'll talk about that. And his, what do they call it? His legacy.
Ooh.
Yeah, exactly. Legacy. Jude Bellingham did a thing. We'll talk about that. A little bit on Manchester United's new system, first game under Ralf Rangnick, of course. And then we've got some Aston Villa, Leicester City, West Ham and Chelsea. Very exciting. What an exciting day. But also, you know what else is an exciting day?
I'm going to stick my neck out and suggest that the answer isn't Tuesday.
It's not Tuesday, but it's every day that I look at The Athletic, which could be a Tuesday, because there's always good content on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
Did you read anything exciting over the weekend?
Not over the weekend, but I did this morning very helpfully read some stuff on the train coming up about Marcel Brands.
Paddy
Boyland and Greg O'Keefe.
All stuff you knew already, of course, you, but any ordinary reader would be learning a lot from that. Great deal of value.
So many things they would learn.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you can learn for free for 30 days by visiting theathletic.com/TIFO. Theathletic.com/TIFO. And join us in our heaven of fun, The Athletic.
You can't put a price on education.
Well, some people do.
Well,
I think your parents did, but maybe they were wrong too. Who could say?
Who can say?
Anyway, I'll leave you now in the warm hands and the cool embrace of private education. That's Alex. Yeah. Just to be clear. Let's pick things up at the beginning here with Marcel Brands, who was Everton's football director?
Yeah, director of football. He worked under, obviously, the ownership structure and alongside a manager, although the relationship between managers and directors of football changes depending on the appointment. So you have a certain kind, like he had a certain kind of relationship with Marco Silva, which was much more, it appears, discursive and collaborative. By the time Rafa Benitez came in, Benitez was much more, no, I don't want to say dictatorial, but had his own very strong opinions on the kinds of players that the club should be signing. And of course, what that does is it creates a process by which a club is kind of zigzagging between different types of targets.
Mm.
And that is not an ideal circumstance for a club to operate in, but particularly for a director of football to operate in.
Yeah. We've seen that fairly recently a few times in the Premier League, haven't we? Teams going, managerially speaking, from one style of football to a complete different. I mean, there's quite a big jump between Carlo Ancelotti and Rafa Benitez, isn't there? Who, it's worth pointing out, the club have reaffirmed their support for.
Yeah, there's definitely a jump there. There's also a jump almost philosophically between Marco Silva and Ancelotti. So you've got a person who is looking to develop younger prospects, wants to integrate players from the youth team towards someone like Ancelotti, who's much more in tune with working with an established squad, bigger name players. That's why someone like James Rodriguez came in. And now Benitez, who particularly, I think, based on the kind of work that he's done, his reactive football, his kind of low block and then counter-attacking style, which is why experienced players like Andros Townsend and Rondon are helpful for that. But it does seem like it's not just the style of football, although obviously that is significant. It's also the kind of the operating ethos of the club as well can transition significantly.
Well, given that he was a football director, Marcel Brands, the main part of his job would be, at least the most public part of his job, will be bringing in new players. There's quite a big legacy there. Everton have spent a lot of money in the last few years, you know, in pursuit of those slightly different styles. As we said, we were talking earlier about how exciting they were at the beginning of last season, having brought Alan and Decore and Rodriguez in. You remembered this hammering of Spurs at the beginning of the season, which was exciting. Couldn't be further from that now. I mean, I think there's eight games without a win in a row now. But let's have a look back at some of their purchases over recent seasons, because as we said, lots of money spent.
Yeah, so it's running close, according to Transfermarkt, to about 300 million. And obviously that's only fees. That doesn't take into account wages, agent fees, so on and so forth. So there are some definite hits on this list. So if you go back to 2018-19, Luca Digne, the left back, has excelled. Richarlison, I would say everybody agrees, is a very, very good player.
Sure.
Going forward slightly, I think someone like Gbamin could have been really good, but he's just had a horrendous time with injuries, and I think that's incredibly unfortunate. It is difficult to find anyone else in the 19-20 cadre that is particularly impressive.
Who have we got on the list?
Alex Iwobi, Moise Keane, Andre Gomez, Fabian Delph, Jibril Sidibe. I mean, it's not amazing.
Sure.
But then moving forwards into 2021, Ben Godfrey, very smart signing, which apparently Bill Kenwright was quite involved in. Alain Doucouré, who I think, as we both agreed before the podcast, has been one of their outstanding players. Rodriguez, I think, is a really interesting one because obviously he kind of changed the tone of the way they played. He did produce moments of real quality. He lifted supporter expectations, but also he kind of made supporters feel good about stuff. So there's a value to that.
And he was good at the beginning of the season, at least.
Yeah, exactly. And now you've got a really interesting situation where they've only spent 2 million in this last window, and that was for Damari Gray, who I think has been good.
Was Townsend on a free?
Townsend was on a free. Begovic was on a free as well. Yeah, who knew? And Rondon was on a free.
Right.
So that does potentially indicate that there has been a tightening of the belt, which I think is probably fair to say.
Yeah.
But also, these are players that are the kind of players that Benitez wants to work with. You know, they have a certain physical profile, they're experienced in the Premier League, they're good at counter-attacking football. And I think, you know, Everton's form has ebbed away because, again, at the beginning of this season, we were looking at a team that weren't necessarily really exciting to watch, but were producing good counter-attacking football that was quite effective.
Yeah.
That has kind of fallen off now.
I mean, significantly.
Yeah.
Two draws in their last eight games, six losses. The draws were, interestingly enough, were at home to Tottenham with a red card and away to Manchester United, although seemingly that's fairly easy these days, or at least it was. Losses to Manchester City, losses to Brentford, Liverpool, West Ham, Watford. So not the easiest run. But given how supporters felt towards Rafa Benitez, broadly speaking, when he arrived, having previously been the Liverpool manager, of course, it's not a good start, is it? It's not going to help him win anyone over.
No, I think that's certainly true. I think the other thing is that, generally speaking, it's fair to say the Premier League is kind of the home of the most innovative and modern coaching now. So obviously you've got arguably the three best managers in the world are all at Premier League clubs. Also, this kind of quite incisive, pressing, high-energy style of football seems to be making its way through the Premier League to greater or lesser effect. And then in Benitez, you've got someone who is kind of a throwback, who's a lot to do with defensive organization, to do with counter-attacking, low block rather than press, that kind of thing. And so from a stylistic perspective, even if you didn't have the Liverpool connection, you've got a guy who's basically managing like 5-10 years ago, and that's not thrilling either.
What does that say about Everton as a team, though, and their expectations and their desires? Because as you said, we go from Carlo Ancelotti, who left understandably to go and manage Real Madrid. Fair enough.
I think that's reasonable, isn't it? Yeah.
Benitez, his most recent Premier League job was Newcastle, where he did some fine work, of course, and all the supporters adore him there still. But presumably that says something about your expectations as a club, right? If you're going to hire a manager like Benitez, knowing how he plays and what he's there for, is it unfair to call him the sort of highest possible profile version of Sam Allardyce? That sounds really unfair.
It sounds really unfair.
He's also
a
winner, right?
Right, and he's won the Champions League. He's done phenomenal work at other clubs, particularly I think Valencia. I think the issue that you have is that, like I say, football has moved on. But also Everton are a really weird club in terms of they are traditionally one of the bigger clubs in England. They've had periods of really sustained success.
Yeah.
But also they have sort of yo-yoed between that, you know, kind of the aspirational eighth to sixth place, you know, we should be challenging for the bottom end of Europe, that kind of thing, towards this feels more like a retrenchment, more a sense of Premier League survival is the crucial thing. I mean, I'm not saying that Everton are going to get drawn into a relegation battle, but there is a difference between appointing a young, progressive, ultimately not very successful coach in Marco Silva, or a big name like Carlo Ancelotti, and then someone like Benitez, who is much more reactive and much more traditional. And that feels like Everton saying security over ambition to a degree.
Which team is it, though, in the Premier League that has made that choice in the top half of the table, let's say, for Everton's sake, in the last 5 years, and it's been the right thing to do? I mean, a good example recently, I suppose, would be Mourinho going to first Manchester United and then Tottenham. You could make an argument to say that there were different reasons why that didn't quite work out. But in terms of the style of football, it also wasn't really working outside, perhaps, of against some of the bigger teams. Is there another example of a team in a similar stature to Everton that have made that sort of stylistic choice and it's been successful for them?
Gone for security over progression, you mean?
Yeah. Because I think of Everton, not perhaps right now, but in the same kind of position as Leicester, for example, right? They're a team who now have some money, who have the ability to attract certain players. They might be able to reach the Europa League positions. They could have attract players on the basis of them playing in Europe. Mm. They have a platform from which to kick on, along with a forthcoming new stadium too.
Yeah.
Rafa Benitez, it's not a criticism of him as a manager. It just doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand why they've chosen him.
Yeah, I'd say probably the most positive example of that would be Moyes at West Ham.
Yes.
In the sense that obviously West Ham have had the London Stadium for a while now. They can't necessarily attract the right good caliber of player, but they've been very astute in the transfer market recently. And Moyes, I think, is characterized as a certain type of coach. And the work that he's done there is unquestionably brilliant. So is that the same sort of thing? It's hard to say. Again, you're also assessing these people by their legacy, their previous jobs. You know, some of what Moyes has done previously at Everton, for example, in terms of constructing a very, very well-drilled side relatively inexpensively. And pushing them further and further up the table by increments, that is very successful. I think, you know, Moyes hasn't necessarily evolved enormously tactically, but you can't question his ability to find bargains and work as a man manager.
Sure,
He organizes teams brilliantly.
Like
West Ham are great to watch for that reason.
No, that's fair enough. Okay. Well, Everton currently 16th place. 15 points. They are 5 clear of Burnley, who are 18th in the relegation zone. I'm looking at their team, though. They have a good team. This is like the last match out, and it's worth pointing out, we're recording this on Monday. They play Arsenal this evening. Everything we said could be completely different. Perhaps they'll win that game. Who knows? But the last game out, it was against Liverpool, of course. Rondon and Richarlison up front. We've got Townsend, Decore, Alan, Damari Gray, Lucadinha, Michael Keane, Ben Godfrey, Seamus Coleman. That's not a bad side.
No.
It's not a side that I would expect to lose, or lose 6 of the last 8 games, despite that fixture run being fairly difficult. They should be fine.
Yeah, they should. I mean, obviously, Mina is injured. Calvert-Lewin is injured. Mina contributes quite a lot in terms of set piece threat as well. Calvert-Lewin is an exceptional forward,
which is the big story, right? He's been out for a long time.
He has been out for a long time, and you know, you can see him dovetailing really well with Richarlison in a front two. I just think that maybe there's an argument that Everton's approach in the beginning of the season worked quite well as teams were adjusting to the pace picking up again. And so the way they were playing could work, and teams are now adjusting to that. They are pressing more. They're a bit more organized in that respect. Everton are struggling to match that because they're still playing quite reactively and haven't adapted.
Mm.
That's fine if you have really strong, aggressive forwards that can run the channels like Calvert-Lewin. But as soon as you take that ability away, they're just a little bit easier to work out than some other sides, I think.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to talk about Everton again in the future, I'm sure. Next up, Jude Bellingham. Referee thing. Did a thing here, which was interesting. This came in the aftermath of Dortmund's hosting of Bayern Munich over the weekend. 2-3 was the result. Munich, of course, taking the points there. Jude Bellingham was giving a post-match interview and referring with his comments to a penalty decision that he thought was the incorrect decision, a penalty given against Dortmund. And he said, and I quote in his interview, "You give a referee that has match fixed before the biggest game in Germany, what do you expect?" Now, what do you expect to be the result of that kind of comment, Alex?
I think Jude is probably going to be in some trouble for saying that. You know, so Felix Zweier was involved in the 2005 Bundesliga 2 match fixing scandal. He basically was part of a small group of referees who then handed in Robert Heuser, who was the kind of the referee who was the architect of that scandal. We did a video on match fixing on the Illustrated channel, which covers some of this, but he did take money to fix or be part of fixing a result. So it's true in that regard. I think what's interesting about it is that Jude Bellingham is a young man. He's grown up in England. He probably would not be aware of this scandal if it weren't something that all the players were aware of and talked about.
Yeah, unless he watches TIFO.
Which
is possible.
Which is possible. And I hope that he hasn't watched the video where I talk about how wonderful he is, because I get a bit starry-eyed, and that would be maybe slightly embarrassing. For both of us, but
only be embarrassing for you.
That is probably true.
Yeah.
It would indicate, I think, that there is a lack of confidence that the players have in this particular referee. I mean, yes, okay. Yeah. After a result goes against you, and there's a contentious decision, then it is likely that you'll feel aggrieved towards the arbiter of that decision, irrespective of any context.
Yeah.
But at the same time, for an 18-year-old English player who has come into the league like a year and a half, 2 years ago, to be aware of something that goes back to 2005 and reference it in a post-match interview indicates that it is common knowledge. And how, therefore, can the players have a great deal of confidence in that referee's ability?
Do you think, then, like, hypothetically, and I'm just trying, I think your point is correct, not how does he know about it? It sounds like he couldn't have researched this stuff on his own, right? But it's probably unlikely that he's come across it in his extensive reading of the history of German football. I think that, I don't know Jude Bellingham, but I think that's unlikely. Is it more possible that the players have a nickname for the referee, or if a decision goes against them, and this referee gives the decision, maybe they're uttering under their breath, or they're in their dressing room saying, you know, basically the equivalent of "that match fixer"?
I think the thing with match fixing is that, and this was something that I came across when I was researching the video that I wrote, is that it's endemic in certain areas, you know, less well-developed leagues abroad, but to fix matches in even the second tier of European football is incredibly difficult.
Sure.
Because there's so much oversight and things get talked about. It's much easier to hide it somewhere else.
Sure.
So
too many people know about it.
The games are too watched. Exactly. Yeah. And so I think there is a surprise factor to a referee being able to do this. And apparently, in terms of Heuser, quite consistently over a relatively long period of time, that it should stick out more. It seems, yes, I think it's very unlikely. It's not unlikely, I don't know, but this is something that happened 16 years ago when Bellingham was two.
So, Christ, when you say 16 years ago like that, after you said 2005, I have a little heart attack.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, we're almost in 2022. But yeah, I think it's extremely possible that something like that is lodged in the players' minds because of the infrequency of that kind of event.
Yeah.
And so I would therefore struggle to understand how that referee has the same degree of authority. Now, of course, that's within the context that we're discussing where a decision has been a contentious one.
Yeah.
He's probably refereed loads and loads and loads of games without there being any contentious decisions and nobody talks about it.
Sure.
So yeah. Is it just that when something like that happens, there is an easier avenue by which to attack him than there would another referee?
Yeah. It's like every time I burgle a home, right? I walk past hundreds of homes without burgling them.
Mm.
But just that every time that one home, and then it's like a big thing. You know, Jude Bellingham, though, does it tell us anything about his attitude, you know, as a kind of, not in a kind of, he's got an attitude way, but, you know, his general attitude as a football player, he's been sort of pinpointed before as someone who could be a leader in the future. You know, the position that he plays on the pitch suggests that he has a vision and ability and is a good communicator.
Yeah.
It's an interesting, it feels, and he someone like he says that, it's a choice to say it, isn't
completely
it?
Completely like, that. Yeah. Yes. I think it's really interesting. I mean, if you read about Bellingham, one of the things that stands out is his willingness to learn about stuff, including clearly match fixing scandals.
Sure.
And his maturity. And that, you know, as any young man or woman who moves abroad and lives in another country for professional reasons at that age, that does require a great degree of maturity. So this is not, there's nothing that I've read about Bellingham that indicates he would make sort of knee-jerk comments, that he would not speak without considering quite carefully before he spoke what he was saying.
Yeah.
It does feel like, yeah, a deliberate choice. And I think it also speaks to a growing leadership role in the Dortmund dressing room. He's appointed himself the spokesman for the team in that regard, and to get this off the chest, which is presumably like a corporate decision, not corporate in the sense of the club.
Sure, yeah.
A group of people in the dressing room feel aggrieved by this thing, and he is the one that steps forward and eloquently discusses it. So I think it's a really interesting indicator of how he views himself within that dressing room.
I'm very curious to see how lengthy any potential ban that he will earn will be, because it's a fairly serious accusation.
It is a fairly
serious accusation. I mean, he's not making an accusation it directly, but
well,
he again, we'll say for those who've forgotten from the 5 minutes ago, you give a referee that has match fixed before the biggest game in Germany, what do you expect? I mean, it's vague enough that maybe perhaps his match fixing experience has made him nervous as a referee, and therefore he's making mistakes. You know, you could argue that that's what he's saying.
Absolutely,
right?
Could argue.
It's delicately spoken.
Oh, I think. Yes, I think his words were,
I mean, not that delicate,
fairly carefully chosen.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
We'll find out. In fact, maybe listeners will already know. Again, it was a day ago that we said these things. Okay, we'll go for a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about another German, but that doesn't work. You know, we'll talk about Ralf Rangnick.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, let's talk now about Ralf Rangnick, who is Manchester United's new interim manager. He oversaw their first game this weekend against
Crystal Palace.
A 1-0 victory. I did know that. I watched the highlights. Anyway, it was quite interesting, wasn't it? He used the famous 4-2-2-2 system, Alex, which, it strikes me, has already been used in the Premier League, of course, by another Ralph. Mm. And it's your Ralph. It's Ralph Hasenhüttl.
My Ralph, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the system, broadly speaking. We can apply it to the Manchester United players. But for now, what is the point of it? Because it seems very narrow.
Yeah, it is quite narrow. I suppose it depends on how aggressive your fullbacks are. They are the ones who are predominantly looking to create width, although also what you'll see, and so when Leipzig were doing this system a lot, you'd have one of the strikers very often pulling wide and quite deep. So it would be, generally speaking, Yusuf Poulsen would take up positions wide left, and then he could drive forwards on a kind of out to in run, or potentially tuck inside and allow a fullback or a wingback to overlap. The main point is, I suppose, that the attacking players are the two tens, as it were, occupy the half spaces. So they are up but in slightly from where they might be in a traditional 4-4-2 as kind of either orthodox wide midfielders or wingers. And that allows teams to build through the half spaces, which generally speaking are better places to attack, because if you're facing a back four, then there is a natural kind of channel between the centre-back and the full-back, and the half space is an area that you can overload. At its best, that system has a reasonable amount of rotation. The sixes, the defensive midfielders, will push up into the central spaces. There will be overlaps and underlaps from the wide defenders, the full-backs and wing-backs. The strikers will pull wide or tuck in. So it should be quite mobile and quite flexible. And also then it allows you to have four or six players in the central areas for counter-pressing, which is obviously crucial because you want more players around the ball in order to press and then spring forwards when you're back into an attacking transition.
And we saw that fairly aggressively against Crystal Palace at times. It was worth pointing out that the game wasn't hugely exciting. It wasn't the sort of classic display or anything. But those initial signs of those tenets are there. And Ralf Rangnick said after the game that he was pleased and surprised with how well the team had taken to it. Players that seemed to particularly stand out from the highlights, Victor Lindelof was one of them, who was extremely high up the pitch, pressing alongside Harry Maguire, but making lots of tackles and, you know, starting attacking play with nice passes, much more direct than they would normally be. Fred, of course, who we'll come on to talk about, scored the winning goal. But also, Sancho had a nice game, and Ronaldo wasn't alone up front. Marcus Rashford was in a slightly more central position too. The difference, I suppose, with this fixture was that Diogo Dalot and Alex Telles were the fullbacks. Now, one of the things we've talked about before as it relates to these, I suppose, slightly more narrow systems up front, is that it really does require good fullbacks. It requires fullbacks who have lots of energy and lots of attacking intent. And that's something that perhaps Manchester United have struggled with a little bit in the past, maybe certainly with Wan-Bissaka on the right-hand side.
Yeah, Wan-Bissaka's kind of like a progressive cul-de-sac. You know, once the ball goes to him, it's unlikely that unless he carries it forwards, it's going to move particularly vertically. And teams have certainly basically sat off Wan-Bissaka or pressed or marked in such a way as to funnel possession towards him.
Yeah.
Because then it doesn't really go anywhere.
Let me ask you this about him then specifically. He was a very raw talent at Crystal Palace, right? He was brought into Manchester United and has predominantly played under Solskjaer. We are aware of the seeming coaching issues during that period of time, right? Wan-Bissaka is still a young player. Is it possible that he's just not been guided correctly? Is it possible that now under Rangnick, you might see, because he seems to have all of the talent. We know that he's capable. What he's quite good at is beating one player, right? Yeah. I think the issue is what happens after that.
Yeah.
But these things can be coached, right? His positional intelligence, which is not fantastic at the moment, can be coached. Do you think there's a chance that we'll see him improve a lot over the next year?
Yeah, I'd hope so. I mean, you don't drop £50 million on a fullback who is an exceptional one-on-one defender. I mean, one of the best in his position without question, and then go, oh, well, because he's not that great at passing, we should just give it to the other guy. That seems kind of stupid. I think the issue is that for the development of the team as a whole, Wan-Bissaka needs to do that very quickly. And it's always going to be a balance between playing a player alongside coaching him, obviously, so that he can work out these new situations and new responsibilities, or going, well, he's not ready now and he's not going to be ready for a couple of months. But then by denying him the game time, you deny him the opportunity to practice those things and to make mistakes and learn from them. So it's a tough call. People have talked about, you know, potentially deploying Wan-Bissaka as like an outside center back in a three. Some people have suggested he should play as a defensive midfielder. I think that's kind of insane. Ranić is going to come in and make tough decisions to get an immediate impact, because he's not in the business of, you know, like, obviously that they want to develop players. That's always been part of the RB model. And they've used their parent club, child club, I don't know, feeder club.
Yeah.
The child club.
That's right.
To move players through. And so player development within a structure is super important to Ranić. But also he will have an expectation that a player who's cost £50 million and has started in that position pretty much, I mean, this is one of the weird things
about...
he started
every game before he took a knock a couple
of
games ago.
When United spent quite a lot of money on Telles, who had a fantastic record before joining the club, he never looked likely to dislodge Shaw. It was kind of like...
At the very beginning when he arrived, it seemed that that might be the case. And then... almost as if by magic, Luke Shaw was suddenly good and was undroppable within minutes of him arriving.
Sure is good. But, you know, Ranić's pressing system as well does require quite a lot of positional intelligence and discipline. So this was something that was visible in the match. He wants to make the pitch side a lot smaller. So he will, you know, if the ball is on the left-hand, United's left-hand side, then the players on the right really tuck in significantly. This is one of the points of the 4-2-2-2, is you get that overloading of numbers in central areas. Mm. And he may just worry that, you know, if Wan-Bissaka is too far over or too near in or something, that it's going to disrupt that kind of shape. Also, they have to push very far forwards. Now, there is an argument for bringing Wan-Bissaka in because of his recovery pace and his... excellence in making recovery tackles.
Yeah.
If that high line that you were talking about is bypassed, then having Wan-Bissaka in the side is actually extremely useful.
Yeah.
But does it narrow too much of their attacking play down the right-hand side, and could it cause positional problems when they're pressing? Possibly as well.
Diogo Dalot was also very good in this game.
He's a very good player.
Alex Telles was also really good.
Yeah. I mean, they are both excellent fullbacks who, for some reason, just never got a look in.
Yeah. Confusing. Well, anyway, I'm sure we'll see more as those games go on. We said we'd talk about Fred as well, who scored the winning goal with his right foot. Very impressive. We've mentioned this a couple of episodes before. We've talked about it. I know JJ's mentioned it in a tactical analysis video that he made about a week ago. Fred is exactly the kind of player that could really thrive under this Rangnick system. Can you tell me why that is the case? Because we're seeing it, I think, but I'd like to understand what it is. What changes have occurred that have enabled this?
I think there's two really important things. The first is that in possession, United's DMs were being asked to drop off and really facilitate build up from the back, but because of other stuff that we've talked about in the past, particularly with McTominay, this wasn't really happening. You have two players who are not necessarily instinctive DMs. Going way back when Fred was at Shakhtar, he would drop off and do this, but he would, generally speaking, he would carry the ball forwards rather than then try and create line breaking passes himself. And of course, in Lindelof and Maguire, Man United have two centre-backs who are actually pretty good at their own kind of passing game.
Yeah.
So what it allows Fred to do in possession now is much more of a kind of shuttly, quick pass and move style, much shorter distances, much less of an expectation of penetrating the lines with his passing. And that suits his style.
A harrier.
Yeah, and out of possession. I mean, one of the things that Fred's always been good at is pressing and working really hard off the ball.
He's quite springy, isn't he?
Yes.
As in, like, he kind of moves from player to player very quickly.
Yeah, he moves from player to player.
He's really good at turning. His turning circles are great.
Right, and he also has and this is, again, something that JJ's highlighted before, is he's really good at knowing where to fill in when other players push forwards. And I'm not saying that Fred is as good as Konrad Leimer, because he's not, but he will fulfill that sort of role. So he will be in possession, he will be a a useful link player who keeps things relatively simple, but has the energy to be in the right place at the right time to continue the ball progression forwards quickly. He will fill in when other players are pushing up. He'll allow United to press higher up the pitch because he also has the energy to get back and recover into that space. And he will make sure that their press is fairly coordinated, which is obviously the biggest single thing that Rangnick has to improve.
Okay. Well, it's curious, isn't it? It's quite fun. Quite fun to see him scoring a goal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember there being a joke not so long ago. It sounded like from within the dressing room that he should never be allowed to shoot because he can't shoot. Someone laughed at him, didn't they?
Yeah. I've always been a bit more up on Fred than most people. And I feel, I don't feel vindicated because whatever, but, you know, it's nice.
Sure. There we go. Now, let's talk about Aston Villa. 2-1 Leicester City. You watched this game. Here are my notes. Leicester are bad. Two more goals conceded from defensive set pieces. Taking it to 10 for the season. That's bad. I've written that there. I believe that's first in the league for that particularly bad. You don't want to be first in the league for that. They're on a bad run. I've written bad four times here. I don't really know why. I was hoping you would explain it to me because I thought they were good, but apparently not right now. And also, before we started the podcast, JJ told us that in the second season of his Football Manager save, they got relegated. Wow. So not that that actually means anything, but, you know, fun titbit there.
Sure.
Tidbit?
Titbit, isn't it?
Is it a tidbit?
I don't know.
I'll look it up and you talk.
Please do, because we all need to know that. It's a weird one, isn't it? Because I think basically, yes, they can't defend set pieces. Like, they are so bad at defending set pieces. And this is a problem with this slightly weird hybrid of zonal and man marking. What it does is it exposes players who are zonally marking. And I'm thinking particularly of Soyuncu for the second goal, who was kind of being expected to contest a header without having any awareness that Konsa was steaming towards him and was going to have the jump on him and the momentum. I think Schmeichel has dropped off significantly this season as a goalkeeper. He looked quite flappy. Like, he was trying to get to the ball from some of those corners and trying to assert himself, but it just wasn't working.
He didn't have a great game. I mean, also not helped by the fact that he appeared to be being booed by the Aston Villa fans from the halftime onwards due to the goal that they felt should have been allowed, which I've got stuff to say about, but I'll wait for you to finish.
I'm thrilled to hear that.
And
so, yes, he's sort of trying to climb over players, but because of this zonal marking system, the players are quite close to him. He would also have quite often one or two Villa players on him impeding his progress that weren't being pushed out of the way by any man markers. So that their whole defensive set piece system is bad. I think they're also just missing, I mean, they're missing Fofana a lot. I thought Evans was actually relatively lucky not to concede a penalty for kicking Jacob Ramsey in the air. And Evans has looked a bit off the pace. I think sometimes with defenders, when they start getting more angry and aggressive, it's because their skill set is dropping off. This is certainly, I'm basing this on how I used to play five-a-side football.
Yeah.
And Evans seems to be kind of compensating Schmeichel to a degree as well.
Sure.
By being ragey because he just knows he's not quite as good as he used to be.
Yeah.
Vestergaard hasn't been given a chance. Amati is actually pretty good at filling in, but is quite... I mean, Leicester are quite a short team as well, which is why you think someone like Vestergaard would make a significant difference because he's like 6'5" or something.
Sure. But
they just seem to be struggling. And it's interesting, now that Maddison's back, now that Barnes is back, they should have enough going forwards to be able to take most teams apart.
Barnes with a lovely goal in this game.
Yeah, lovely goal. Mm. But Villa defended really resolutely. They had this weird kind of, on paper, a 4-2-3-1 that actually looked a bit more like quite a lopsided 4-3-3 with McGinn doing a lot of work. Lovely to see Marvellous Nakamba buzzing around and making a nuisance of himself as well. Yeah. So
Buendia, I thought, played well too.
And Buendia has always been a good pressing front foot defender, which again allowed, and Watkins is excellent at that as well. So it made it really hard for Leicester to play through Villa.
Yeah. Three wins in four for Steven Gerrard's Aston Villa. They're certainly playing faster, aren't they?
That's the key thing. Mm. Yeah, there's a lot more intensity. They're pressing better, I think. And it's interesting because we did a Villa video way back. It would have been their first season back in the Premier League where we talked, they were in danger of going down. And we said, you know, what are the things that Villa need to do to stay up? And one of the things was to push the defensive line forwards and press more aggressively in the midfield area.
Yeah.
And they kind of did that under Dean Smith for a while. But Gerrard really seems to have concentrated on this, quite an aggressive battling, you know, even though McGinn's a creative player. He is also the sort of player who really makes a nuisance of himself in those areas.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, to think with Gerrard, he's obviously just come from a winning team.
Yeah.
And you know, install him in a dressing room where the team, you know, at least very recent history would suggest haven't performed hugely well in terms of this season under Dean Smith. But if he brings not just that mentality, but also that approach to games, that expectation that you're going to get something out of it, that you play faster, you play in a slightly more aggressive style, it can lead to results, can't it? And clearly it's doing so.
Yeah, I think so. And that is a team that does have players in it whose natural instinct is to go forwards and to attack space. So McGinn, Buendia, Watkins, Ramsey, Cash on the right-hand side from fullback.
Yeah.
They are all aggressive vertical players. And so by kind of taking the shackles off them a little bit and also encouraging the team to defend a little bit more like that, I think Gerrard is playing to his strengths. One of the things that was noticeable from his time at Rangers, and I'm inferring this from what I've read rather than having ever really watched Rangers, is that he's quite an adaptive coach. So Rangers were much more front foot and aggressive in the Scottish Premiership, and then when they played in Europe, they were more cagey and counter-attacking, and this is obviously a sensible choice. But I think what it means is that Gerrard is not necessarily wedded to one particular style of play. He will look at what works and try and impress that, but is quite happy to change things on a game-by-game basis. And it seems like, you know, people know that Leicester have a soft underbelly at the moment. So target set pieces and, you know, aggressively attack them, particularly in the midfield area, and you'll quite possibly get a result. That's what he's done. It's very sensible.
Well, interesting fixture run coming for Aston Villa in December. Of course, they are in their next game on Saturday. They're away to Liverpool. Gerrard going home there. That's going to be fun. A trip to Norwich Tuesday after that. But then following against Burnley, Chelsea, Leeds. I think Manchester United to come up in January too. So it's half and half there. The half games you would definitely expect them to win. Yeah. If they do win those games against Norwich, Burnley, Leeds perhaps, that's, I think, the thing that's going to really create that distance between them and the relegation zone. But I'm really curious to see how they perform in those other games against the bigger challengers.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see whether he's much, much more cagey and reactive.
Because he wasn't against Man City loads.
No, not loads. And with a player like Watkins, you've always got the option to launch balls forwards and get him attacking the channels and creating problems. And with someone like McGinn, who can then push up from midfield to get into the box on the end of that sort of stuff, Watkins is really hardworking.
Yeah.
Really pulls teams apart and disrupts defensive structures. So you can see a way that Villa would approach those games. Obviously, it's quite hard to see them getting results in some of them. But I think Gerrard is in a good position because he has clearly had some sort of impact on the team. But there is also definitely room for him to grow into that and to get, I think, a bit more tactical shape and tweaking.
Or to adjust to some more realistic expectations over the next month. Yeah.
Yes, that's also probably true.
Yeah, maybe we'll see that.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the player who tried to score that goal when Ramsey. Schmeichel had his hand on it. Was it Jacob Ramsey?
Yeah.
So what's interesting is I was watching Match of the Day and they sort of did the whole thing. They talked about the rule that related to this. So for those of you who haven't seen this incident, Schmeichel makes a save, the ball kind of rebounds off him a little bit, it's on the floor, and then he stretches a hand out and has one of his hands almost entirely over the ball, touching it between his hand and the floor. Ramsey then kicks the ball into the goal from that position, and that's why it's judged to be a foul. On Match of the Day, they seem to get very confused about this sentence. I'll read this sentence to you now, which is the rule. It says the ball is between the hands or between the hand and any surface, e.g. the ground, or their own body, or by touching it with any part of the hands or arms, except if the ball rebounds from the goalkeeper or the goalkeeper has made a save. And the second part of that sentence is what was confusing people, because Schmeichel had just made the save and the ball had rebounded from him. But that comes after the big or in the sentence. The first part of the sentence says that if the goalkeeper has it between the ground and his hand, then it is adjudged to be within his possession. Very clearly, that is the case. Mm. The second part of the sentence doesn't change the first part of the sentence. And I think they missed the or, and then they spent 30 seconds talking about how there should be more punctuation in the thing. I really didn't think it was that complicated. I needed to learn. I didn't know before it happened, because that sort of incident doesn't occur very often.
No.
But once I'd read the rule, it seemed kind of straightforward.
I personally don't quite see what the point of the second bit of that clause is.
I think that is, so this is why I was thinking, if the ball's in the air, right? So say, for example, that the ball had bounced off the goalkeeper,
yeah,
and just out of his touch, and he jumped up and had a hand on the ball in the air, but then a player headed it into the goal from that position, right? That ball is not between the ground, and the player is not between himself and his body. He's just trying to save it, and it's rebounded. He's not in control of it.
Sure.
So it doesn't matter that he's touching it, because he's not in control of the ball.
Yeah.
That's why.
I mean, I don't know if Schmeichel was in control of the ball particularly. I think it's one of those odd things where...
He had it pressed to the ground.
Yeah, when you see it slowed down, it obviously it looks much more like that.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, my general rule of thumb with these sorts of things is that once a decision is made, who really cares anyway?
Sure.
So, yeah.
I don't really care about the decision. I cared more about the interpretation of the rule.
Yeah.
I cared that it was... I felt like it was being made to sound more complicated, not intentionally, but
right.
I don't find it that complicated, and I don't know why. Hey, don't get me wrong, I particularly love Match of the Day too. I feel like the tactical analysis they do on that show is really fun, and they all do a fantastic job. It's not a personal criticism, but I just wanted to take a moment to say I didn't think the rule was that complicated.
It really doesn't sound very complicated to me.
Sure.
No.
There we go. Well, anyway, who cares?
Who cares?
Another thing here, a tidbit, is actually a titbit in the English language is titbit. In America, it's tidbit. Tidbit.
Right.
But do you know what it originally meant, titbit?
No.
It still kind of means this, but it can be applied in different ways. A small piece of tasty food, a delicacy, a morsel.
Oh, no, I know that.
Yeah.
I wanted the etymology.
Oh, I can read it if I can. It's really long.
Yeah.
Could have been influenced by tit and tittle, or tid. The adjective tid meaning playful, frolicsome, lively.
Right.
The noun bit meaning biting or bite. Bite the
lively bite.
A lively bite, okay. A frolicsome biting.
Yeah. You know someone's set up some awful wanky street food stall called Lively Bite.
Sure. Well, anyway, there we go. Let's have another break now. And when we come back, we will talk about West Ham.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Okay, very briefly on West Ham, who maybe deserve to be higher up the running list here today. They beat Chelsea. Was it 3-2? It was 3-2, wasn't it? Very impressive. Well done, West Ham. Tell me about that.
First of all, it had a couple of lovely goals in it.
Mm.
Mason Mount's volley into the near post bottom corner was delicious.
That'll be on next month's Goal of the Month award, I would have thought.
Quite possibly, as will Jared Bowens, who is, you know, kind of quietly becoming a really, really good player.
Sure. There were lots of rumours about Liverpool being interested in him, weren't there?
Yeah, there were, and you can kind of see the point. I mean, he's got a certain kind of aggressive profile. He is an out-to-in wide attacker. He's got a good shooting range. Mm. You can see him. I mean, he's very much an understudy in that kind of Salah role, but there's something there, I think. West Ham capitalized on a bit of sloppiness, and this was quite a changed Chelsea side. Not entirely sure what happened for the third goal. I mean, it's one of those things. You could very charitably say that Masuaku spotted Mendy slightly off his line, and I'm like, really?
I think Tuchel referred to it as a good cross after the game. So yeah.
I think it was a bad cross that got lucky. I mean, Mendy clearly is anticipating the cross. His body angle is twisted slightly towards the left-hand side, and that you know, he adjusts very slowly. But I think it's interesting that West Ham now, I don't know, we probably still expect these sorts of games not to go their way.
Yeah.
But they very clearly don't. You know, they very clearly are going into these, and they are in fourth and have been in the top six for pretty much the entire season, if I remember correctly.
Also, it was interesting because they started the game a little bit more conservatively than they have done previous, which is understandable. They're playing Chelsea, right? But it was at half time when they decided, no, we can get something out of this. That's a confidence that you really only get from a team in form.
I think that's absolutely right. And they're a team with a certain degree of certainty about aspects of their play. So they know that they have very aggressive, physically dominant central defenders. They know that they have in Declan Rice and Thomas Suchek a particularly good double pivot that can get up and down and complement each other really, really well. They know in Mikel Antonio they have a striker who can cause problems to any defense in the league.
He can create something out of
absolutely
any situation.
Nothing, and will also work extremely hard and create space for those slightly more flair attacking players, or indeed Masuaku to cross. But that kind of asset up front means that they know that they will always have an opportunity, because Antonio will be able to bully a central defender into taking a step too far back, and that will create space for Lanzini or Bowen cutting inside, that kind of thing. And that sort of weapon is really, really important. Plus, there's a solidity through the whole of the rest of the team that means that if they want to kind of sit back and camp out a little bit and get a feel for a game before they try and... They can be adaptive in games, is my point.
Yeah.
How much they use Antonio going forwards, how vertical they go, how much they sit off and stay compact, they can adjust as they read a game as it progresses because of the security that they have, particularly in that kind of central square at the base of the pitch.
Yeah. I mean, West Ham now sit in fourth place, 27 points after 15 games. They are 8 points off Manchester City, who are in first place. I'm not sure anyone is realistically expecting them to be title challengers. But in terms of those top four finishing positions, long way to go within the season. Is there anything that we see in their play so far that indicates that they're not possible for challenging that top four?
No, I don't see anything at all. I mean, I think the top three of the league table now are going to be the top three come the end of the season.
Yes, really. The fourth place is a battle between West Ham, Tottenham, Man United and Arsenal, you would have thought.
You would think that, and it's going to be really interesting. Obviously, you know, two of those teams have got relatively new managers. Conte has played four Premier League games.
Sure.
Ranić has really only overseen one. So if those teams make significant improvements, that could imperil West Ham's position.
Mm.
But there's absolutely no reason why West Ham can't maintain this kind of form, because they have, you know, yes, okay, like an injury to Antonio would be pretty devastating. But everything else about what they do and how Moyes has got them playing indicates that they're there for the long haul.
Jorginho made another bad mistake.
Yeah, a bit significant error. From Mendy, yeah.
Yeah. This is sort of, I'm not sure, is the second game in a row? I mean, certainly did it against Manchester United. Maybe it was two games ago. Is this a kind of blip within his play, or is this something that I should have noticed before? I always thought Jorginho was kind of Mr. Secure.
Yeah, I think the problem is sometimes that because that that Chelsea defensive system with those three centre backs. Mendy is a goalkeeper who's good with the ball at his feet. And he obviously usually has another player alongside him in the midfield double pivot. Sometimes they even play two.
Yeah.
That he probably gets maybe an undue degree of security when he's playing back towards his own goal, because there are so many passing options. They're often so well shielded that it is quite easy maybe to switch off. And he does, you know, the ball goes through him a lot.
Yeah.
So in terms of like a percentage number of mistakes, he's still incredibly secure.
Yeah.
It's just that when those mistakes happen, if the ball is heading in that direction and you have a very kind of snappy, aggressive player who's seizing on that error, it's going to stick out more than a player who's making a mistake with like a lateral pass.
Yeah. Okay. Bad timing perhaps.
Yeah. More than anything, I would say.
Sure. Well, there we go. That is all. Seb wrote loads of other stuff on here, including Tottenham 3, nil Norwich. Tottenham, according to a Tottenham supporting friend of mine, not Seb, are playing well for the first time in many years. Said something about how coaching was good.
Yeah.
There you go. We've talked about Aston Villa. St. Pauli, Schalke, Roma, Inter. Ah, imagine the treats we could be having if Seb were only here. But he's not.
Mourinho's in trouble.
He just loves to write that every week, doesn't he?
He just wants to get stuff.
Actually, he's written LOL in capital letters.
Very unsaid. That,
very unsaid.
Yeah.
He hates that man. Anyway, there we go. If you wanted to know the inside story, journalists with agendas, there's certainly one there. Don't trust anything Seb ever says about Mourinho.
Presumably, Seb can be encouraged to address this on his newsletter.
Yeah, although his internet also wasn't working last night, so he didn't do that either.
Ugh.
What can you do? Hamburg, huh?
Hamburg.
It's patchy.
Who knew?
I didn't know. Anyway, that'll do for now. Alex Stewart, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And thanks as usual to producers Sol and Adonis in the backgrounds there. We'll be back next week with more of the same, some more exciting football stuff to look forward to. And hey, a little shout out now for something happening in about 3 weeks' time, Monday the 27th. I'm setting myself an in-real-life deadline now that I can't push because I'm saying it on the podcast. Monday the 27th of December, just after the Christmas weekend, of course, we're releasing a special episode of State of the Club. That'll be released on the TIFO Football YouTube channel. And it's all about Sir Alex Ferguson. There we go. So accompanying that in the week of the 27th, between Christmas and New Year, will be a special podcast episode all about Sir Alex Ferguson, including two pretty fantastic guests, Ollie Kay and Danny Taylor. Exciting, isn't it, Alex?
Yes, it's very exciting. Did you know that Sir Alex Ferguson was the manager when Aberdeen beat Real Madrid 2-1 in the 1983 Cup Winners' Cup?
I believe oh my God, we're going to have to remake the episode. I didn't know that. thankfully, I sit next to JJ Bull. So
literally every day.
Every day he comes in.
Every single day.
He won't let me forget it.
No.
Yeah. Fine. Well, we'll be doing that. So look out for that. It'll be really fun. And in order to justify the amount of time and resource we've spent on it, I really need people to watch it. So that would be great if you can do that. There we go. State of the Club. Alex Ferguson, 27th of December. Also subscribe to The Athletic. We'll be back next week. So goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye now. Goodbye.